Ladies and gentlemen, this guy gets it. Give a huge welcome to Sir Tim Smith.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
I went to see my first bank, and the guy looked at me, as bankers do, and said, "What's your exit strategy?" And I said, "Death." He said to me, he looked at my business plan, he said, "If you can't sum up what you do in one sentence, you'll never be successful." I said, "I'm fucked in that case." Because if I could sum it up in one sentence, I wouldn't want to work there. And one of my great pleasures, and Steve, thank you for talking this morning, it's such a relief to actually find that one of your heroes is genuinely really interesting, isn't it? It's a bit like when a friend has a baby and you have to say, "Beautiful baby," and then you have a look in fear that it looks like a roast duck or something, you know. Have you noticed, I'm going to talk about storytelling, have you noticed how the words "center of excellence," "out of the box," "leading edge," "cutting edge," "bleeding edge," which is when I assume you get too close to that cutting edge, "thinking the unthinkable"? Have you noticed that almost every company and individual that uses those words is in inverse proportion to the meaning of those words? People so desperately want to be innovative. It's a bit like Tony Blair wanting to live in cool Britannia. If you have to say you're cool, you're not. Most innovators that I know are blissfully unaware of the fact that they're innovators. They're just inveterately curious. I'll give you an example of innovation. 20 years ago, ladies and gentlemen, you could buy eggs. Then, excitement of excitements. You could suddenly buy eggs that had been laid by chickens that had been let out of their cages. They were now barn eggs. Then, in a sweep of the imagination, barely comprehensible, within a year, you could buy eggs where the chickens had broken out of the barn and they were now free-range eggs. Almost unbelievably, we then went stratospheric. You could buy eggs from chickens that were roaming free, that were organic. And I can break to you, ladies and gentlemen, some news of such unparalleled excitement you could scarce believe it. There is a supermarket chain I must not mention. But we can now buy eggs by free-range chickens that are organic, that are laying them into biodegradable nests. I think this is so exciting, we should go out and have some tuna-friendly dolphin for supper. Isn't it funny how we use language? My life experience of doing social enterprise, whatever, I happen to think that social enterprise is the most important innovation in corporate structures the world has ever seen. The problem is the people who want to own that territory are unbelievably boring. They're the sort of people who have bad hair, bad breath, and a bad attitude. What I will be preaching about today is that it is possible, and it has to be possible, if you run a successful social enterprise, for you to become a millionaire. How else are we going to attract the brightest and best of our generation to work in that territory? How are we going to tempt the young people who want to work at McKinsey's or Goldman Sachs to come and do this work? And when you go around the social enterprise milieu, you discover there are more vain, stupid, incompetent, corrupt people working in the charity and NGO sector than I've ever met in business. I was asked to be controversial. But it's true, though. It is true. We're supposed to somehow support people because the cause they are espousing is a good one, as opposed to actually lifting the lid on whether the people are competent to deliver it. And if you actually want change, there are two things you need to know about change. If you want change, never mention the word, because the least popular word in the British language is change. People hate change. And yet everybody says, "I want to change the world." No! The secret, at least in the English-speaking world, is to catch change by surprise out of the side of your eye. Change isn't new. Oh, no, no, no. Change is something that has been done many years ago, but dust fell on it. And you can sweep it off and rediscover it. So it's not really new. It comes from days of yore. And now we go on a new journey. I'm serious. I learned about storytelling when... I'll tell you a story. I, in 1981, had a very odd experience. I was staying in the Plaza Athénée Hotel in Paris, one of the finest hotels, not just in France, but in the world. And I was in the Princess Suite, the best room. And I went out in a limousine down the Champs-Élysées, and the record that was playing on the radio was mine. It was the biggest selling record in French history. It had been number one for 15 weeks. And the record that was going to knock it off the number one spot. Shame. I'd written that as well. And I was on the way to the Tour d'Argent to receive a platinum disc. Oh, smug oh me. And I suddenly felt this weird sensation come over me. And I started to cry. And I cried and I cried and I cried. And I never got to the Tour d'Argent. I decided that night that I would give up the music industry. Why would that be? Well, Dorothy Parker, the wonderful American writer, once famously said, "The trouble with getting there is that when you get there, you discover there's no there there." And I think many of us recognize that sense of a desire for something that's somehow out of reach, that when you get it, you hoped that you'd have champagne in your veins. You hoped the world would be neon. And actually, you're on your own in a hotel room with ashes for company. And it was at that moment in my life that I realized the only thing that could actually satisfy you is to release this. I know that sounds a bit hippie, but it's true. I decided... You see, one of the things that's so dishonest about everybody in this room is everybody in this room is smart, but it's bad manners to say you're smart. So we waste days of our lives talking to people, pretending that the time we spend on it is equivalent to the importance of the subject. I've now realized something very important at work. I say to people, if you want to speak to me now, you can have 5 minutes. If you want to speak to me in 5 working days from now, you can have an hour. It is remarkable how smart people can suddenly distill very complicated ideas in 5 minutes if you've given them permission to accept that they are smart and you are smart. Because you've then got 55 minutes to go and do something else. You could go make love, you could drink some Chablis, you could do whatever it is. But you don't have to sit in a bloody room having a meeting. And meetings are death. I went to Cornwall. I went to Cornwall. My life is pretty chaotic because I didn't know I was going to Cornwall, except I was going on holiday, and I walked into an estate agent's and there was a house for sale, and I said, "What is that house?" The estate agent said, "You won't like it, sir." And I said, "Fuck you, I'm going to see that house." I went to see the house, and I went to see it secretly, and the farmer had blocked the road off, so I couldn't do it secretly. I was trapped. So he said, "Come and have a cup of tea in the house, old buck." That's a Cornish phrase, old buck. It's friendly. Yeah. When I was 2.5 hours later, I'd shaken hands on buying this bloody house. And I was intending to move 20 minutes outside London. So I'm stuck in Cornwall. I'm stuck in Cornwall, and I don't know what to do. It's really frightening. Everybody thought I was a multimillionaire, but actually what I forgot to tell you was the greatest lesson of my life was my vanity had been so enormous in the music industry, I thought I knew better than everybody. I built a really expensive recording studio, and I worked with some terrible artists that I was convinced were brilliant, and I blew all my money. So I was in Cornwall, actually not very wealthy, but everybody thinking you're wealthy, which is actually the wrong way around. And, and I was trying to think of what to do with my life. Everybody thinks you've got to be certain. My son keeps saying to me, he says, "What am I going to do with my life?" And I said, "Christ, I don't know. I got to 48 before I really thought I knew anything." And even then it was busking it. I was making it up as I went along. So my life changed. I got to Cornwall, and I was very anxious because I didn't know what to do. And then a friend gave me a pig, and this pig was called Horace. And Horace and I became very good friends. And he'd come in and he'd warm his ass against the arga, you know, cooker in the house. And we got talking and actually became a bit of a one-way conversation. And very soon I realized that Horace was lonely. So I went out and I found him a friend, Doris. And Horace and Doris, they were just great. You know, as a man of my age, you're supposed to say when someone says, "What's the happiest moment of your life?" You're supposed to say something like your marriage or the birth of your first child. But it's not true. The happiest day of my life was in November 1990 when, with horizontal snow at 2 a.m. in the morning in a barn outside my house, Doris gave birth to 13 baby pigs. I cannot tell you the excitement. I decided I would build a rare breeds park. That was what I must be wanted to do. That was where my career was going to go. So I found some land. I was going to build this park. And the guy said, you can't have that land, but I just inherited an estate next door. Would you like to come and see it? So I went with him to see this estate the following day, which had a once famous garden. I was rather surprised to go round a famous garden with a machete. We went round, and you've got to imagine it, ladies and gentlemen, 15 foot high of brambles and ivy. And we cut our way through, and we came to a brick wall, and this big brick wall was about 12 foot high, and in the middle of it was a green door, just a little bit ajar, with rusty hinges and the paint flaking off. Is there anybody in this room who would not have wished to put their shoulder to that door to open it? That is what being an entrepreneur is. And I moved in, and in the place was a huge vinery with the wood long rotted out, and the glass was hanging lethally in the brambles. But my curiosity got the better of me, I cut my way in. And suddenly the sun came out, and on the wall of this greenhouse were some scissors, some old vine scissors. And you know those paintings in the 70s of dots that always used to frustrate you? Someone would say, what a brilliant elephant. And you'd say, what fucking elephant? I can't see it. You know? It felt a bit like that. Suddenly I could see tools everywhere. And I fell in love. I didn't know anything about plants except green side up. That's all I knew. But what I had learnt in the music industry, which is really important to know, is that if you're not a freak and you love something, there will be millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people who feel the same way you do. So I knew I needed the public to know about this magnificent lost garden, so I called it the Lost Gardens of Heligan. Very romantic. All the gardeners who had worked there had died in 1915. They had enlisted in the Devon and Cornwall Light Infantry and had been wiped out in the First World War. And the owner had been so sad, he put a fence around the garden, and no one had gone in there until I broke in. So I took a lease out on the place, and we persuaded the BBC to come and do a documentary, and it was an award-winning documentary. It was brilliant in every respect, except one. They forgot to mention we weren't open to the public yet. So the day after this TV show, a coach turned up bearing the ladies of Dartmouth. The next day, three coaches. The third day, my builder, Tiggy, he said, look, we've got one of those portable blue toilets. Yeah? Why don't I just rip the toilet out and I can stand there, I'll get some tickets from the supermarket and we'll sell people tickets to come in. So we did that, and then they'd come in and they'd see us working in the middle of this garden, and people would say, wow, what's that? It was fantastic. And we'd talk and they'd say, what's up there? You say, no idea, mate, but here's a machete, why don't you go find out? Best business plan I ever drew up. You were paying to come in to do the work. I then made another big mistake which would transform my life. I thought I was good with children. I'd forgotten that, of course, you're good with your own children because they depend on you for birthdays and Christmases and feeding and that sort of stuff. Other people's children have no such loyalties. But I said, I'll take these school groups around. And they came. And they hated me. For 3 days I was going to do it, and the first 2 days were the most stressful of my entire working career. On the second night, I was reading my kids a story by Roald Dahl, and I was tense, and the following day I came in, my tummy like a drum, and there were these 60 children in front of me, and I knew what to do. No more Mr. Nice Guy. I looked at them and I developed my sneer, and I said, I'm going to tell you about poison. I'm going to tell you about the poisons that will burn through your stomach lining and you will drip, drip, drip to death. Respect. They were mine. Warming to my task, I told them about the drugs invented by the ancient Aztecs to stop live human sacrifices screaming as their still pumping heart was being ripped from their chest cavity to be held up to celebrate the dawning of the summer solstice. At this point, I could have walked them through fire. They never believed plants could be that exciting. And an idea was born. Most people are put off science if they're not scientists because scientists can't be shagged to tell stories. And storytelling is what it's actually all about. So I had this dream of taking somewhere that was completely derelict, poisonous almost, and transforming it. But the reason I wanted to transform it was because I felt if you could take the most unhelpful place and create life in it, how much more optimistic can it get than that in terms of a sense of hope? And the Eden Project was amazing to do. I won't bore you with the details of it, because I'd be here forever and you'd get bored. But it had certain innovative strands to it. Number one, I've learned that the biggest innovation in the modern world you can have is trust. It's an old one. Do you remember that? The dust's come off it. But it's absolutely serious. We did an engineering contract called the New Engineering Contract, which is based on a handshake predominantly and hadn't been done since the days of Christopher Wren. And everybody told me, they said, Tim, your reputation is going to be in tatters. This project will be late. It'll be over budget. And I was getting worried until my son told me that I didn't have a reputation. And then, somehow, only your children can do that. But somehow it was all right. You know what? We built it on time and on budget. And we opened it on March the 17th, 2001, St. Patrick's Day. And we opened it on St. Patrick's Day because the guy who made it possible was a guy called Jerry O'Leary, an Irishman, who came out of retirement so he could tell his grandchildren he'd worked on this project. Because up until then, he'd built nuclear power stations and roads. And in 1999, when we began work, the hillside where our visitor centre is collapsed. 1.5 tons of crap fell into the pit. And Jerry said, do you trust me? I said, I've got no choice. He then made the 60 shortest phone calls I've ever heard that literally went like this. It's me, Jerry. You know where the fuck I am. Come here now. Boof. And I don't know if any of you have seen the movie Con Air. Those guys were pussycats compared to the crew that turned up at Eden. And these guys were driving the Tonka toys everywhere. But in 6 weeks, they rebuilt the hillside, redesigned our drains. 17 miles of drains. And of course, you're thinking, how do you build drains in a clay pit when the way that you mine clay is to put it into solution with water? Well, you don't, you see. This is the problem. The engineers hadn't thought of that, but this Irish guy did. So 17 miles of drains with one layer of plastic, a meter of granite, a layer of plastic, a meter of granite, a layer of plastic, a meter of granite. We built it up by 51 feet. So the water pours through, because we're 30 meters below the water table. The sediment all gets caught in the plastic. And then the water is clear as a mountain stream. I own the sexiest drains the world has ever seen. But you know why this is important? I learned so much. Do you realize the foundations, which are nearly a mile long, not one bit of them is longer than from me to that wall there. And some of those foundations are in grade one granite, the hard rock, but others are in the gloop, the grade four granite, bouncy, watery stuff. And yet over the entire length of the foundation is allowed to settle by only 20 millimeters, or else the whole structure is unsafe. And it settled by 8. Isn't that exciting that humans are so clever? Doesn't that make you feel nothing is impossible? I think it's brilliant. Our superstructure, the whole superstructure of Eden, weighs almost to the ton the same amount as the weight of the air contained inside it. It is that light. The heaviest things at Eden are the steel rods holding the structure down from floating off. And it's the first conservatories ever built, that are not a monument to the vanity of architects. Because we get something like 93% of the light comes through. We can get sunburn inside. We have the biggest collection of productive plants the world has ever seen. And 14 million people have been to see it since that time. We've put £1.2 billion into the Cornish economy. And we are a social enterprise, but we're very political. We have 3,000 suppliers. And we give them long-term contracts. Why do we give them long-term contracts? Because if you do short-term contracts, people can't go to a bank and borrow to build their business. Whereas we actually always buy local, even if it's more expensive, unless the reason it's more expensive is in their incompetence. But it's really important. Remember The Godfather, part one. You know the old guy at the end when the gangs are meeting to stop the fighting, and the old guy walks across and Al Pacino says, I thought he was dead. And his sidekick says, no, everybody around him made money. It's true. If you want to live a long and happy life, create a system around you where you are part of an ecosystem. Social enterprise is no different to any other form of business, except in the hands of people who want to pretend it's worthier. Yes, you have social outcomes, but actually great business should, by its very nature, have social outcomes. I believe in four things. I believe in Tinkerbell theory. I believe that if you can get three people to believe something, it will almost certainly happen. I believe in last man standing, which holds that if you have a certain amount of charm, and people know you won't go away, they will eventually pay you large sums of money to go away. I do something really weird, which you might like to listen to. I accept every third invitation I receive. It's not that I don't accept the first, but I always accept the third. Everybody thinks they're so open-minded, but most people only go to social functions that are held by their friends or their professional groups. And idiots, and there are lots of them all over the world, think that magic is created by meeting the people you need to meet. This is not true. Read history books. Magic is made by meeting the people you didn't know you needed to meet, which is a completely different thing. And you can only meet people you didn't know you were not meant to meet, you were meant to meet, by putting yourself in jeopardy, by being in places where you weren't supposed to be. My life is a complete roller coaster of experience. I never know who I'm going to meet. I have been known to go to places, fall into good company, and not go to the thing I was meant to go to as well. How unprofessional is that? But there's a reason, and when I wind up to talk about the way we manage our organization, you'll understand the reason. I'm obsessed by the notion that people think they have opinions. They think they think. Ask yourself a question. What do you hold strong feelings about that you know nothing about? And it's frightening when you realize almost everything you've got an opinion about, you can't actually recollect why you have that opinion. There's a famous bit of graffiti I once saw as I drove into Wales, which says, "Some open minds should be closed for repair." I have two more things in my mantra of how I do things. But just staying on that, going to unusual places, I had to go and talk in a Nissen hut near Taunton. 50 people and a dog were going to be there. My PA threatened resignation for the 10th time. What am I doing, wasting my time? I have to go. I went. I talked. There were 50 people and a dog. 3 months later, I'm in Plymouth for a meeting of the European Commissioners deciding how they're going to divvy up the money for the 5 counties of the west of Britain. The Eden Project was going to get nothing. The internecine war was total. And suddenly this old man gets up. He says, "My name is Humphrey Timperley. I'm chairman of Somerset County Council. And 3 months ago, I went to a talk in a Nissen hut near Taunton. And I saw this man, Smith, talking. It's quite obvious to me he's got the wider West Country as a concern rather than the narrow confines of Cornwall. And we've talked to each other here in our Somerset Council, and we're going to drop 2 of our projects so the Eden Project can go ahead." That talk was worth £12.7 million. And it happens all the time. The most extreme version of it goes to the last thing I believe in is lying. I do a lot of lying. It's a phrase that doesn't go down well, so I've actually come up with a different phrase to cover it. It's called the telling of future truths. It all began with a hopeless love affair with a blonde concert pianist from Zimbabwe, which of itself sounds unlikely, I know. And in a vain attempt to make myself appear more interesting, I told her I was a diving instructor, which wasn't wise, and I wasn't even a good swimmer. And anyway, I then knew that I had to either fess up and lose all chance, or become a diving instructor. So in 1972, I found myself decanting myself into the Western Approaches for 7 weeks with 6 members of the Special Boat Squadron, which is the SAS with webbed feet. And I became a diving instructor. In case you're wondering, she didn't find me any more interesting. But the upside was I was now a diving instructor. But the most extreme version of future truth-telling happened in May of 1997. I want you to be with me because this demonstrates attitude completely. You have, over the previous 18 months, persuaded nearly 100 people to leave their jobs, and they're working for you for nothing out of offices at the Lost Gardens of Heligan. You have bid to the lottery for some money for this project, and the day comes and the decision is going to be made. There's going to be grade A, you've got the money. Grade B, you've nearly got the money. A few more questions and we'll give it to you. And grade C, what on earth were you thinking about? To add insult to injury, they were going to tell us by fax. So I think I'm the only person in the world that's bought a fax machine to receive just one fax. Anyway, out it comes. Z-z-z-z. Grade A, we're not grade A. Z-z-z-z. Grade B, we're not grade B, we're grade C. Okay, what do you do? Your dream is about to die. Do you go and see all your mates, people who sacrificed so much, and say, I'm sorry, fellas, it's over? Or do you tell a big lie? It's obvious you've got to tell a big, big lie. So I did. We called all the television networks. We phoned all of the newspapers, and they were going to come to Heligan that afternoon for our announcement. I borrowed a big Victorian bath. I spoke to the fishermen in the village of Mevagissey. Could I borrow some sacks of ice? I spoke to the co-op shop. Could I borrow 5 cases of champagne? And I borrowed some glasses from the local hotel. All the press were there. And I got up on stage. I filled all the glasses. And I said, I want to say one thing. I want to thank the Millennium Commission for their support. I love you. Yes! Raised a glass and left the stage. I never said they'd give me any money. The interesting thing was, the London Times, the following day, gave a huge leader to the insight, about the insight of the Millennium Commission for giving us this money. They said, what an inspired decision. This was exactly what they should have been doing. The BBC website had picked it up. Everything was just hunky-doodle-dandy. And within 3 weeks, the Millennium Commission actually believed they had awarded us the money. Do you know what I mean? Okay, to wind up, I just got to say 2 things. The last and most serious thing you need to know if you're going to be a social entrepreneur or an entrepreneur of anything, right? I hope there's nobody in here from human resources or personnel, because this is going to hurt, okay? I believe something passionately, and it goes like this. Kill negative people. Don't just kill them, disembowel them and put your heel in their innards and do that. You know why? No one's honest about this. Do you know what they are? They are alien spawn. They are. And you know why? Because they want to kill your dreams because they can't have their own. Therefore, they want to crush them out. When you spot a negative person, you've all done it. Have you ever been to a pub? Start of your pint, you've got a great idea. By the time it's finished, people have told you, if it was such a great idea, someone else would have thought of it already. It happens all the time. Think of all the great ideas that are weeping in corners of pubs. Lonely, unwanted. Kill them. Okay, the very last thing I want to say is, I was told by my chairman of trustees that I could no longer run the Eden Project like a gang leader. We had 550 staff, and it was going really well. And he said, Tim, no, you haven't got any corporate governance. And I said, what's that? And he said, damn it, man, you haven't even got any KPIs. And I said, what are they? And he then told me what KPIs were. And I said, but surely if you've hired the right people, you don't need to give them an infantile list of what is expected of them. They'll know. And he gave me one of those looks which only old greybeards can give you. One of those. He said, Tim, if we can't sort this out, one of us will have to leave. Not hearing the message clearly, I said, Christ, I'd be really sorry to lose you, Ronnie. And anyway, I then realised the seriousness of the situation, and I got myself 3 bottles of very good wine, and I went home for the weekend, and I wrote a management manual for the Eden Project. And within months, we had most of the big companies knocking on our door saying, oh, we want a bit of that training, we want that. What it is, it's called the monkey business. And there are eight and a half rules. Rule number one is you're not allowed to start work at the Eden Project unless you've said good morning to 20 people. It doesn't have to be 20 people. It's not some weird religion. It's just the principle is that actually people do an extraordinary amount of work in communicating by having social conversations before they start. Rule number two is you've got to read 2 books that everybody that knows you would say were completely outside your sphere of interest and review them for your colleagues. Rules 3, 4, and 5, you go and see a concert, a movie, and a play, same rule as number 2. How else are you going to rip the blinkers off your eyes?